This podcast is brought to you by Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine for those that love to make and drink great beer. To learn more or to subscribe, visit beerandbrewing.com or find us on social media at Craft Beer Brew. It's episode 351 of the Craft Beer and Brewing Podcast. I'm Jamie Bogner. My guests today are Joe and Will Quinlan from The Big Friendly. Welcome, Joe. Welcome, Will.
Thanks for having us.
We'll figure out how to track your voices so people can keep track of you later on here. but this is a fun one. We're actually doing this here in the podcast studio in the Craft Beer and Brewing office, a place where we don't do a lot of podcasts. I record all my remote ones here. But we don't get a lot of visitors up here in Fort Collins for some reason. But you guys are here hand-delivering your World Beer Cup entries, and you flew out from Oklahoma City, dropped off those entries at the BA warehouse this morning, hoofed it up here to drop off your entries for Craft Beer Brewing's IPA issue. And when I saw you were going to do this, like, hey, we should record a podcast while you're here, even though you are flying back out at 4 o'clock this afternoon and have an incredibly tight schedule to get back to return the rental car, get back to the airport and all of that. I appreciate you making time for
the podcast. Yeah, thanks for having us.
The reason for this, obviously, you know, for anyone who's paid attention to GABF, Big Friendly, The Big Friendly, sorry, I'm using your proper article there, The Big Friendly, and for the last 2 years in a row has won Brewery and Brewer of the Year in the 251 to 500 barrel category at GABF. You've won back-to-back gold medals for Oblique and Bent, a kind of a session Saison farmhouse beer. You won a silver in 2022 for Textured Fabric. In 2023, you won gold also for Tapestry from Asteroid. Winning two gold medals last year was enough to nab you those honors, and certainly not a small feat. And then, of course, with our own judges in this most recent malt issue of Craft Beer and Brewing, you sent some barrel-aged beers our way that absolutely crushed it. Vanilla Boom scored a 99, was the top score in that flavored barrel-aged stout category with our blind judges. Oblique and Bent itself scored a 97 with our judges. Year 3, barrel-aged stout, 95 with our judges. Rummy, another barrel-aged stout, 93 with our judges. Lots of great scores. You know, of course, that creates an interesting story. And naturally, we want to find out how and why you are doing things the way that you're doing and finding so much success in that. So I want to focus on this episode of the podcast on two things we don't normally talk about in the same conversation, and that's farmhouse and Saison beer, as well as barrel-aged stouts. We're going to dive into both of those things, and we'll figure out a way to tie it all together thematically so that it makes sense. But before we do that, at G&D Chillers, they always strive to build great chillers. Partner with them as you build great beer. But don't just take it from me.
Hey, this is Josh Erickson of Chafuncta Brewing in Mandeville, Louisiana. The team at G&D were a critical part of our 10X expansion, always just a phone call or email away. And thanks to their superior equipment, technology, and documentation, commissioning our new chiller was smooth and straightforward. Now we can't wait until we need to upgrade our existing chiller.
That's right. Choose G&D Chillers on your next expansion or brewery startup and receive one free year of remote control and monitoring of your new G&D chiller. And ProBrew is changing the game at this year's CBC in Las Vegas as part of ProMoc Craft Beer Solutions. They're presenting a holistic approach to craft brewing operations. Through their display of animations, holograms, and machinery, they'll be highlighting how they can advance every aspect of your production line. Visit go.probrew.com/CBC24 or contact them at contactus@probrew.com to schedule one-on-one time with one of their subject matter experts at booth 1783 at this year's show. ProBrew, brew your beer. Also, are you struggling to source affordable citrus ingredients due to market fluctuations? Try Old Orchard's flavored craft juice concentrate blends, which mimic straight concentrates at a better price point and with a more reliable supply. Old Orchard citrus flavored blends include blood orange, grapefruit, lemonade, lime, and tangerine. To learn more or request your free samples, head on over to oldorchard.com/brewer. I should also mention the first time we talked about doing this podcast was at the tiki party at the GABF at Bierstadt. And I remember, I laid some groundwork. It's amazing how many podcast episodes have now come out of hanging out at that party after GABF. But it's really easy to spot folks with medals around their necks. I'm like, huh. you know, let's get this conversation started. Well, yeah. So, Joan, well, where do we start? Where do your beer stories start? And, you know, and then, you know, trace for me the arc, you know, from becoming a beer fan and drinker into becoming a brewer and then into this world of deciding to start your own brewery.
Yeah, I think it was when I moved to San Diego. This is Will speaking,
so people can track voices here.
Yeah, we grew up in Northern California, and when I moved out and I moved in with my brother in San Diego, and just, you know, there's so much great beer down there, so you get really excited about it. And at some point, I was just, you know, having some beers with my friends, and I was like, I think I can do this. I think this is something we should try. And so we started homebrewing and making just, you know, terrible bottle bombs, and just as everybody does.
Sure.
And then I think by that time, Joe had already moved to Oklahoma. But when I moved to Oklahoma, we started homebrewing together. And then we immediately made friends with some brewers at Coop Ale Works out there. They were one of, I don't know, maybe four or five breweries at the time. And they were excited because they're like, wow, you're actual beer lovers. Like, because there wasn't really anything going on in Oklahoma City at that time, 2010. And so to have people from Southern California, like, you know, these meccas of beer, you're like, wow, you know what you're talking about. You know, you've had great IPAs that we're trying to make, you know. And from there, I think we both ended up working at Coop Ale Works at different times. And then I started brewing for them. And then Joe can probably talk about.
Yeah, I had moved out from San Diego, the mecca of craft beer, out to Oklahoma in 2007. There was one brewery in the whole state in 2007.
Yeah,
it was sad. And there really wasn't very much being distributed there. There's not really a big craft beer drinking crowd. Even today,
sure,
by percentage, there's not a really big craft beer drinking crowd. So when Will moved out, it just kind of felt right for us to brew together, learn to brew stuff that we wanted to drink, that we could drink, that we could share with others. And we were really welcomed into that.
Create the culture, right?
Yeah.
That you want to see exist.
Really, that was some thoughts that were going through our heads there, because it was so small and so intimate. Everyone that was involved in the beer scene back then would be at the same bottle share on the weekend.
Sure.
Everyone, I mean, there's so many that have breweries or have bottle shops now or got into distribution or own a beer bar. We all hung out together. And I remember going into Coop Ale Works. We had brewed two batches of malt extract beer. And we walked into Coop because they did this test batch on a West Coast IPA, which we couldn't find a West Coast in the state. And we just walked in there on a Monday or a Tuesday, just randomly. And we hung out with those guys for 3 hours, drinking some beer, talking about our love for beer. And 1 week later, a good friend, Blake Darlam, who's the head brewer at Coop Ale Works, came over to my sister's house. We didn't know the guy.
Sure, sure.
And he taught us how to all grain brew. And he was just all about coming over and helping us out.
Yeah.
And from that point on, we would go in and help clean tanks, help on the canning line. They would give us ingredients, grain, yeast, hops, send us out the door with that. So we were brewing for free. We were brewing every week at that point. And we had some guys to lean on if we had any questions or came across any issues. And so our learning curve really accelerated back then. And I worked for Coop for about a year, and then Will worked for Coop for 6 years. And that kind of laid the groundwork for opening a brewery up.
I love it. Get your local beer fans hooked on brewing and get them trained up on homebrewing at all grain so that you then have qualified people that you can bring in and work at the brewery. Smart.
Yeah, it was really cool. And I started a business in 2015. The Big Friendly, before it was a brewery, was a mobile beer bus. And it still is, actually. We take it to public events and private events around the city, and it really helps with the business, the sustainability of the business. And I don't see a lot of beer buses out there, and I feel like there should be more in cities that we go to visit. And so if any brewers...
So beer bus, tell me, what's the beer bus about?
Well, it's a school bus, and I saw a lot of food trucks at different street festivals and things like that.
Sure.
I also saw breweries selling beer at these same festivals. So I just figured out the laws on how to sell beer off of a food truck type vehicle. And so I bought a school bus, built out the interior. There's a walk-in refrigerator. The interior's, it's like a little tiny pub or tavern.
Seating inside the bus?
There's seating inside the bus.
And then taps inside and outside?
There's taps inside and outside the bus. We don't drive it around like a party bus.
Right.
It's supposed to go somewhere and sit stationary and act like the neighborhood
mobile
bar,
pub, yeah,
wherever we happen to land. And so the idea just was really well received. And so that business ran for 5 years before we opened the brewery. We opened the brewery in 2020.
Well, that's a great time to open a brewery.
It was amazing.
November yeah. of Perfect. 2020.
Yeah. Yeah, I couldn't have asked for a better month or year to open a brewery.
But it's interesting to see the brewery kind of evolve out of another beer business and become a brewery, because that seemed like the next natural extension. You know, and so where did you go from there? You decide to open a brewery and you build out a brick and mortar brewery with your own brew house then.
Yeah. Actually, 2016 was when we decided to open a brewery. That was when we were asked to open one. He was still working at Coop back at that time. And it took 4 years of planning, and we built the building was from scratch, from the ground up.
Yeah.
And so that was kind of nice in some ways, but in other ways, it just took a lot longer.
You built a building from the ground up. A building.
A building from the ground up, yeah.
That's the hard way.
A building and then the brewery and, of course, the tap room. Will was working at Coop during this time. He gave his 2-year notice at some point.
2-year notice.
I mean, yeah. Seriously, it ended up being that.
Okay.
They were very kind.
Yeah.
They wanted him to stay there as long as possible, and we just had such support from them, and we still do. But yeah, 4 years later, in November of 2020, we opened the doors, and it was difficult, but I think we've done all right. You know, we're doing all right compared to a lot of breweries that out there right now. There's a lot of closings in our town at the moment. So, I mean, it's like 4 or 5 or 6 of them that have closed in the last
couple months.
Yeah, 6 months or so. So, but yeah, we feel really grateful and fortunate that we've had such a great response to the brand and to our product, and people are showing up and supporting us, and we're able to, we don't do a lot of distro. So a lot of our, most of our business is through the tap room or events. We do a lot of events away from the brewery. So
sure. Sure. Well, yeah, you know, I feel like podcast hosts get pigeonholed with certain questions. I listen to the Decoder podcast with Nilay Patel, and he always asks people about their org charts. My standard go-to question to kick things off is talking about the creative process as you think about the beers that you're going to make, you know, and what's going to reflect your brand. I want to talk about that, how you settled on the beers that you wanted the Big Friendly to be known for, and then how you went around, you know, coming up with what those beers were going to be and how you're going to design them. But before we do that, streamline efficiency with Omega Yeast's Diastole Knockout Series. The DKO series is comprised of 8 familiar yeast strains engineered to knock out the formation of diacetyl before it starts. The strains you know now better, available now for made-to-order pitchables at any volume. Contact Omega Yeast today at omegayeast.com. Also, ABS Commercial has been a full-service brewery outfitter for over 10 years. They're proud to offer brewhouses, tanks, keg washers, and preventative maintenance parts to brewers across the country, as well as equipment for distilling, cider making, wine making, and more. They know the ins and outs of the brewing and installation process and can design the perfect setup for you, whether you're just starting out or looking to expand. Contact them today at sales@abs-commercial.com to discuss your customized brewery needs. ABS Commercial, we are brewers. And if you're a brewer who's also interested in distilling, subscribe now to the Craft Spirits and Distilling Podcast, available on all of your favorite podcast platforms. Hosted by Sydney Jones, head distiller for Few Spirits in Chicago, and Molly Troop, master distiller for Freeland Spirits in Portland, Oregon. This podcast explores the technical and creative processes behind great spirits through conversations with some of the leading distillers working today. It's everything you love about the Craft Beer and Brewing Podcast, but focused on distilling. Click on the link in the show notes to give it a listen. I've had a lot of fun putting that together with Molly and Sydney. I get to be producer on that one and just stay in the back, and I don't have to host it, just get to help out and help make it real, which is, it's been a lot of fun. Anyway, so let's get into the creative question there. you know, you actually had a, you know, good number of years to do market research through the beer bus, get a feel for what drinkers in Oklahoma City were interested in. You build an audience, build a following, you know, but, and that's actually an interesting way to go into launching the brewery itself. Like you knew what was going to, you know, what people are going to respond to. And you also had an opportunity to, you know, help guide interest of people through other people's beer and the beer bus leading up to that. But when you decided to start the Big Friendly, where did you decide to focus? And tell me about that creative process as you thought about designing the beers, you know, that were going to reflect the Big Friendly.
I think we, well, on my side, I've always been a big fan of Saison, and Joe's always been a big fan of stouts. And so we both had that, and then we kind of met in the middle on IPAs and lagers. So, and that's kind of how it ends up. I take the reins on Saisons, and Joe does all the recipes. I mean, I might brew them, but Joe does all the recipes for stouts.
Well, that's interesting. So you split up the creative approach there.
Yeah, it's it makes it kind of nice because, yeah, I don't know if I'd want to make stouts. I'm not a big stout fan. I'll probably have, you know, 4 ounces in the winter time, and that's about it. I'll take a lager or a saison any day. What do you think, Joe?
Yeah, so we really wanted the brew beer that we would drink. We wanted the space that we wanted to hang out in, so we designed it that way. And I feel like our approach has just been, let's brew beer that we're going to drink. So we do like lager, pilsner.
Which is that's a kind of a trope that we hear a lot.
Yeah.
And, you know, I've gone on both sides of that argument. I can see the argument, well, you know, you need to brew the beer that people want to drink from you, which is also a very viable argument. But I think there's something to that, brewing the beer that we want to drink, because you end up passionate about it. Mm-hmm. And I think that there's something interesting that when you are passionate about it, you tend to focus more on it. You tend to dive a little deeper. You tend to want to, if now you have to please yourself. And so oftentimes some of the best beers that we taste are beers that those brewers are so individual, that those are the beers that they want to drink. Yeah. And they're really good at it because those are the beers they want to make.
So being from California, IPA.
Sure.
Just, that was the first beer I had that was craft, was an IPA. This is probably what everyone has, but it was Nelson.
Nelson
from Alpine. Yeah, we used to live 20 minutes from their little hole-in-the-wall tap room.
Sure.
And so that was my first experience with the brewery, and that was the first beer I had. And I was like, this is ridiculously tasty, and I would love to learn how to make something like this, but, you know.
Imagine Alpine Nelson being your entree into craft IPA.
I don't know, something different. But, you know, for us, Pilsner Lager, we're learning a lot. We're in process. We look at it as, you know, every day we're learning something new. We're adapting the way we approach brewing these different styles. IPA, we typically make either pale ales, hoppy pale ales, or single IPAs. And we don't typically go above 6.5% with the ABV. We don't really make double IPAs. We've never made a triple IPA. And those are the two styles we drink the most of, but Saison and Stout are styles that are close to our hearts because one, you're messing around with yeast and bacteria. The other one, you're messing around with grain, different ways to blend malts together, and that's really fun. At least that was one of the funnest brew days for me as a home brewer was brewing a Stout. A little bit longer brew day.
You got to use lots of different malts.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah,
all right.
That's fun. So that's kind of how it has been reflected in the brewery and tap room for us. Is just, what do we want to make? What are we going to drink? And these are the styles that kind of came out from that.
Yeah, except for, I mean, Saison is hard to sell these days.
Sure.
It gets there. I mean, people buy it. It's just a lot slower. It had a heyday. What was that? Mid 2014, 15? It was just going crazy. But I don't know why it dove off.
I keep hoping. I think that, you know, all of these things are cyclical, and I found myself more drawn to Saison again this year. Drank a lot of Saison. I was down in Phoenix a couple weeks ago, and you know, I think like everything, you just grew, you know, it's going to come back. It's going to come back, and it just takes brewers that are passionate about making it to keep it going, and I think that people, you know, the IPA, the hazy IPA, you know, cycle is going, the lager cycle is going, the future of beer is all of these things concurrently. And I think Saison plays a part in it, but that's a good segue to talk about it, Will. You know, you get into Saison, your approach to Saison is mixed culture, you know, generally mixed culture based, or do you have different lanes that you, you know, roll in for Saison?
I'm always experimenting. I mean, if this wouldn't have won, Oblique Invent wouldn't have won, I probably wouldn't have made it again, because that's what we do at the brewery. We just keep experimenting and making something new every time, you know, whether I'm switching out, you know, flake barley for oats or spelt for wheat or whatever it is.
Just nonstop experimentation.
Just nonstop experimenting. It makes it fun. I think that originates for me from working at a big brewery, you know, and which was great. I learned a lot. I learned a lot how to make consistent beer every day. But coming away from working in a bigger brewery, you kind of want to do something different, and this kind of forces me to be creative, and it just makes it more fun.
So where do you start then? You know, obviously experimentation is something that everybody engages in at various, you know, points.
Yeah.
You know, where's your idea, you know, behind Saison start? Does it start with a flavor idea? Does it start with, you know, the culture itself and, you know, riffing off of, you know, a previous batch that you've done and figuring out how to steer that? I mean, you know, I imagine, like you say, there's some amount of iteration that happens here, but then the refinement is where, like, a lot of that magic happens. How do you go about, you know, some of those pieces?
Yeah, I think I start with a few of those. I mean, so inspiration for sure. I think being in San Diego, inspiration for me was Lost Abbey, and they're all their Belgian beers and wild beers, and then and Russian River, you know. And I lived in Northern California for a while, so Russian River was a big influence. And then being in Oklahoma and being able to do this on a commercial scale, their brewery like you know, like Petite Prince from Jester King,
sure,
is like, oh my god, I want to make that beer, you know, you just look to other breweries for inspiration, or I did, at least for this, because I think I wanted to make Petite Prince. It's not that, definitely not that, but it's along those lines where it's a low alcohol Saison.
You know, the T.S. Eliot and then, you know, filtered through Picasso quote of, you know, mediocre poets copy and great poets steal. I think there's something to it that, and Picasso riffed on that with artists. But the idea that, you know, making imitation of something is not, you know, is, you know, artistically viable or vibrant as taking that and making it your own. And, you know, and so figuring out how to take that inspiration from someone else and turn it into your own thing, that becomes your beer, that also then becomes the thing that influences people. That's the match. Like, so how'd you think about going about that? Not that that could be your intent, but, you know, your goal isn't to make a copy. Your goal is to, you know, take a framework and, like, I want to make something like this that's my own.
Yeah, I wanted something I can drink all the time. I knew going into it that, you know, they use their own cultures there, and I don't, for this style of beer, I don't. So I just think I wanted something. I needed a Saison yeast, and I wanted it to be a little bit funky, so I grabbed some Brett yeast. And then what I did was I had...
Where'd you get the... Where'd you source cultures from?
A lot of times I get them from Yeast Bay.
Okay.
But I mix it up. But yeah, Yeast Bay mainly. And then they have a lot of Bretts you can choose from, lots of Saison bases you can choose from, and I like to mix and match and see what I come up with. I don't always know what I'm getting
into. What does mixing and matching feel like then for you? And does this creative process start with the yeast, or does it start with grist?
I think it starts with the yeast for me.
Okay.
Yeah, I'll read about what they have and what they think that the yeast company says this is going to turn out like, and then I'll try it, and it may turn out like that or may not.
Sure.
So it's just a lot of just testing.
Do you test in small batches with smaller amounts of yeast before you roll into, you know, larger scale production?
I did do that a lot early on before we started the Big Friendly. So I was doing a lot of 5-gallon batches when I was working at Coop, just on the side on the homebrew system. So I was kind of going into our commercial system. I knew I had a handful of yeasts I knew I loved, and so I just stick with those.
You say a handful.
Yeah.
How many yeasts? and so you're also actively doing different blends of these yeasts, looking for something that's going to handle more primary and then something that's going to add a little bit of Brett and funk to it. I'm kind of keep drilling down into some of your creative process around building some of these blends.
Yeah. In the homebrew process, I would do 5 gallon batches, but I would split it off. I would use one yeast for one batch. I would not mix them. So I knew what this yeast would do, and I knew what this Brett would do. And then eventually if I like these two, maybe I would try to co-pitch them, or I would, do Brett and secondary. So, it's really just trial and error. And we also did.
Yes. But there's also a process to it. How do you, like, what do your notes look like on that? Do you just file them away in your head?
Pretty much.
Okay.
I think when I was homebrewing, I did have a notebook that I had notes for that for sure. But now I just know that what I like, and so I'll stick with that.
Well, and then of course it's not just the culture itself, and so you know, it's also how you manipulate that culture, temperature, time, all of these things feed into the way that those cultures work.
For sure. So yeah, I think one of the biggest things for me was letting the beer sit, letting the saison rest. And so nothing gets bottle conditioned earlier than 2 months out after fermentation. So I think that's at least for me, maybe I'm crazy, but when I'm making saison, if I turn that in 2 weeks and bottle condition it, it's going to be a totally different beer than letting it develop in that fermenter or in that barrel. It just had so much more character.
So let's go back to the yeast question. I don't think I'm ready to move on from there yet. You have some strains. What would a typical blend look like between, yeasts that are doing heavy on the primary fermentation, and then the cultures that are going to add, Brett or other kinds of, acidic elements to it? How do you think about those? How do you split some of those? And tell me about your process in building some of these blends. Is there a timing, issue to it? Are you, pitching your primary stuff first and then, hitting a point where you're then throwing Brett in? Do you blend and, pitch them all at once? And then do you repitch those cultures? How do those blends shift? I'm curious about this.
Yeah, all of that. Actually, okay, I do all of that.
Let's pick it apart. We got some time here.
I like to definitely reuse that yeast. So when that beer is done, if I had another tank, I would love to move that beer out into secondary and then immediately reuse that yeast, but I don't have that luxury. Mm.
The demand for saison is not such.
It's not,
that you're...
No, like we're already only making 3 barrels at a time.
Okay.
And for our fermenters. And if we're going into barrel, we only have 6 barrels that we work with right now, 6 barrels and one puncheon.
Yeah, we have three 3.5 barrel system or fermenters for saison. And that's what we brew into for saison or wild projects. And then a lot of those will get transferred into barrels, and that gives
us
a little
more.
How big
is the brew
house? 10 barrel.
10 barrel.
10 barrel system.
So are you then brewing and splitting out into multiple fermenters after one brew, or?
We did that at first.
And then you still couldn't move 10 barrels.
Kind of
saison.
No. Okay. It takes a while. Yeah. I think right now we might have too much saison, but.
I think what's happened though is we have won some awards for the saison that we've put out, and there's no saison available anywhere. So anyone that happens to like saison in our general vicinity comes to us. And so we get through the saison, especially on draft. Bottles move a little slower for us, and we can't, not that we distro a lot, we're in less than 10 accounts, but it's hard to sell a case of saison to any bottle shop. And so we just keep it in-house, and eventually it sells. And we like it. We like drinking it, and Will loves making it. So, and he does a really good job with it. I think we do have a little too much at the moment, but that's all right.
We'll get there.
It's not a beer that needs to get drank fast.
You're building a story to tell to local beer drinkers through this. Even though it feels like I'm spending a bunch of money on competitions, that tells, you know, folks that wait, this is really good. And if I want something a little bit different, this is a great way to explore that. You know, and in fact, in that sense, it becomes weird to even talk about, well, Saison doesn't sell. It can sell, you know, it's mm-hmm. just how do you sell it? You know, it becomes this other question. And I don't want to get into all the, like, you know, business details of that. I still want to focus back on fermentation and not let Will off the hook on this. So talk to me about building your yeast blends, Will. You know, how do you think about what to blend and why, and then, you know, how you go about, you know, some of the building those blends.
And, you know, it's really loose. Like, it's because we don't make consistent brands, I can just do whatever I want every time. And sometimes I don't even think about it. It's like, I like this yeast. I've used it before, or I haven't used that yeast, and let's give it a go.
There some workhorses that you go back to just because you find that they're really, they're giving you what you're looking for?
Yeah, for sure.
What are they? And if there's anything proprietary, obviously I respect your boundaries on that.
Yeah, I mean, I would just say go to the Yeast Bay and use anything that they have. All of that's great.
Are there some specific Brett strains that you lean towards that you just find that work the way you like them to work? Because there is a nice kind of dry, slightly woody, dusty Brett character to this that isn't as funky. It's definitely not the kind of as fruity as some of the Brett expressions I might get.
Like something in the middle, yeah.
Yeah.
Something balanced. The thing for me, I think. The thing I do think about a lot that I use is not from the Yeast Bay, but we make bread at home a lot. And so we use our leaven. And so tuning that sourdough starter is a lot of fun. Hmm. That's something I dial in. So if you overfeed it and, you know, you really feed that yeast, you're going to get like a Belgian wit beer. And if you kind of starve that yeast a little bit, you need more of that lacto. And so sometimes it's really nice. It ends at like, you know, 3 pH is like perfect. And, it, you know, we can blend it with fruit or we can do whatever we want with it. I think that is something I think a lot more when I'm using Saison yeast.
Yeah.
Is trying to dial that in. But if I'm going to make like a classic Saison, you know, there's just two or three strains I'm going to go for in general.
And so you're saying the starving versus the feeding is one of the major ways that you are kind of massaging this yeast.
Right, right.
And how does temperature figure into that also?
Yeah, well, with something like oblique or something like...
Sure, something like oblique.
Some oblique, like, I mean...
We're talking about it now.
I'm fermenting in the high 70s.
Yeah.
And then I'm just letting it ride. I'm not thinking too much about the temperatures at all. I ferment in the high 70s and then I
just let it go
let it go where it's going to go. I don't take,
is there some seasonality to it?
But I leave it there and I don't take the glycol off. I just leave it at 78. Oh, I know some guys just let it ride.
Sure,
But I like to keep it below 80.
Okay.
At least with something like this.
Keeps a little more tightly
Keeps
controlled.
Keeps it contained, yeah.
Okay.
Not too funky.
Interesting. And, and that yeast will still get you where you want to go. Even at that slightly cooler Saison temp.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. Then let's talk about, since I think we're hitting our limit here on fermentation, let's talk about building a grist base for it. You know, you mentioned that you obviously when you're making Saisons, you're more into experimenting and trying out grains. Are there some kind of, you know, standard go-tos that you find that build the kind of heft? Because this is a small beer in the 4% range, mm-hmm. but also has this big, you know, like feels, it's got a body that feels much bigger than the ABV might suggest.
Yeah, for sure. You know, I was actually looking at the recipe yesterday and I know, it's like 70% wheat, flake barley, oat type. Yeah. 70% adjunct and then 30% pills. So I think that's where a lot of that body will probably come from.
A lot. Yeah. Well, and then, you know, how do you go about mashing in this one?
And
I shouldn't, before we get to that, I'm getting ahead of myself. Anything particular in how you select some of those individual, grains and adjuncts that go into this? Are there some go-tos that you love just because of what they provide for body?
Yeah. I mean, as far as, providing body, I'm a big fan of spelt.
Yeah.
and flaked barley. And then, you know, using small amounts of unmalted wheat.
Flaked barley.
Flaked barley.
Yeah?
Yeah. And then small amounts of unmalted wheat.
When you say small amounts, what do you mean?
You know, like 5%.
Okay.
Yeah.
So not a super dextrinous wort, but just enough to kind of give it a little to
just,
chew on.
Just a little bump. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then anything interesting to your mash process on that?
I wouldn't say it's anything outside of the box, no.
Step mashing?
No.
Single infusion?
Single infusion.
Huh?
Yeah, we don't have a system for that. That'd be great if we had the ability to do
sure,
that.
Sure, sure.
Especially when doing lagers these days. Gosh, that'd be amazing. But no, single infusion. You know, something probably like, you know, 149, 150.
Right. Low enough to hit the kind of attenuation that you're hoping for in this.
Yeah, for sure.
Anything else, you know, to the way that you mash on it?
No, I don't think there's anything too interesting on those lines.
When it comes to hot side hops, I mean, this is not a terribly bitter beer, but there's a small but reasonable hop character to it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like something earthy, something, you know, I think this one has some Goldings for the bittering. And then we use some New Zealand hops for like late edition Whirlpool.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Tell me about that.
Yeah.
What New Zealand hops do you find add a complement and like, you know?
Well, it's definitely something not dank.
Okay.
So,
sure.
Yeah, we went with like a Mochueca.
Okay.
And
because I can absolutely see, I mean, I often describe those as like fresh or rain or, you know, petrichor or white linen or, you know, something on that, which you absolutely find commonality between some of those hop characters in New Zealand hops and, you know, the same kind of descriptors you might use in a Saison. And so it seems natural to me. I'm interested in that.
Yeah, we've been big fans of
Mochueca.
Mochueca for a while. So
small amounts, imagine.
Small amounts, I mean, half pound per barrel or something.
Okay.
Yeah.
And just a standard Whirlpool. You know, imagine you're not going to great lengths to lower temperature or anything like that.
No, not with this beer. No.
A little bit of the bitterness is okay. You know, in the Saison.
Mm-hmm. Just enough to stand up.
So Mochueca. Anything else on their Whirlpool side? How many IBUs is this, you know, typically hit?
It's got to be 15 to 20.
Yeah, so, yeah.
Yeah.
Reasonably low.
For,
yeah. Then, yeah, so a little bit of Goldings for bittering during the boil, then a little bit of Motueka or something similar from the New Zealand side in the Whirlpool. What's next?
And then it's off to the fermenter. There's nothing else after that.
No, and so no dry hopping then in this?
No dry hopping. No,
okay, you keep it very straightforward on the Saison side.
That's right.
Let the yeast do its thing. And as we mentioned, fermentation then happens around 78 and stays pretty consistent, you know, there. How long, you know, with this mixed culture of, potentially wild or sack and, how long does fermentation typically take?
Primary fermentation only takes about a week, especially for something like this. Maybe even less, you know, something in the 3-4% range isn't going to take long. And then it just...
So it's cranking through. Again, where does it get to off of primary fermentation?
It's got to get down to... I think primary gets down to 2, and then as I let it rest, it'll probably get down... It might crunch down a few more points.
Okay. So you get down to 2, and then the Brett really starts to work.
It's my slow work time, yeah. So... I mean, especially if I'm letting it sit for 6 to 8 weeks, it has plenty of time to do some work.
And so you'll let it sit in one of your 3-barrel tanks for 6 to 8 weeks as the Brett just continues to work on it?
Yeah, for sure.
And same temperature, 78, or you let that one go up a little bit?
Well, I mean, by that time, I don't think it has the wheels to make it go any warmer anyways. So
it's true.
So yeah, I just let it ride. And then, we're not cranking through Saison, so letting it sit for 2 months is totally fine.
Holding up our tank space well.
Yeah. Yeah.
On Saison.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Thank you guys for fighting the good fight. Well, I'm not done talking about Saison yet, but I do need to mention this. SS Brewtech was founded by a group of home and craft beer brewers dedicated to bringing an engineering-first approach to brewery equipment. SS Brewhouses are used to formulate new beer recipes at some of the world's greatest breweries, and are the cornerstone of many local breweries. To learn more about SS Brewtech's innovation list, head on over to ssbrewtech.com. Also, did you know your water can change the flavor profile of your beer? Water is the number one ingredient, after all, and uswatersystems.com knows just how to treat it. uswatersystems.com has been at the forefront of the craft brewing industry and created American-made water treatment systems with brewers in mind. Whether you're a hobbyist or a pro, head on over to uswatersystems.com to learn more, because great beer starts here. That reminds me, well, we didn't talk about water. You know, and one of the key portions of Jester King's approach to Saison is that crazy water with a whole bunch of dissolved solids in it. Yeah, off
well, water.
Well water. What does your water look like?
It's just for Saison. Mm-hmm. I usually do, it's just something balanced, something low and balanced.
Yeah.
Low mineral and balanced, yeah. I know, I think theirs is probably super high and the opposite. But
I think it's like 700 on the TDS scale. Like, oh my gosh, so much, you know, so mineral heavy.
Yeah.
Do you RO it, or is it just, you know, you guys get natural, you know, reservoir water that's good?
Yeah, we get it from the city, it goes through a carbon filter, and then we go and test it every
month.
Yeah, so we have a report of what our water looks like throughout the seasons. And then I run that through the old brewing water.
Sure. Well, you know, as you're thinking about Saisons and farmhouse beers in general, obviously you've been pretty successful, you know, back-to-back golds for Oblique and Bent at GABF, Tapestry from an Asteroid also, you know, with its own medal. Like, what do you think is setting your Saisons apart? What do you think it is that, you know, if you had to kind of dial down in that feature of excellence that is making it noteworthy with competition judges, what do you think it is?
Man, that's a good question.
I can speak to that maybe a little bit.
Sure.
Because we're a pretty small operation. I handle the front of the house, Will handles the back of the house, and then that's pretty much it. We have some part-time work that comes on for packaging days, but Will is very meticulous with how he manages the brew space, and he's very clean. Like, there is, everything has its place. He's very thoughtful, and he may not say this himself, but he's just very thoughtful in his approach to brewing and his love for beer. And so a lot of it is just this creative outlet for him, but there's a lot more to it than that. And I feel like if you walk into our brew space, that level of attention is given throughout the whole process until it's being poured out into a glass in the tap room. And I'm not that way with my approach, but he is. And I feel like that carries over not just in the Saison that we make, but in other types of beer that we make. And he's just really good. He thinks of things that I just never would have thought of, purging lines that you just never would have thought to purge. I think there's pipes that just can get lost. And, you know, in bigger brew spaces, there could be some bacteria that's giving off flavors. Well, I just think that he thinks through, we don't have this big brew house, but he thinks through all of those things and keeps a really tight space. And that translates into the beer. Now, recipe formation too, just, you know, before we even got started, we probably brewed 500-600 batches of beer. And that really helps you to understand on the fly, like, what does this need? So we can start to brew to taste. Like, we know what we want it to taste like. And so the formation of the recipe affects that. And so we're not, you know, we don't do test batching. We'll just make the beer because we know it's going to taste good. May not come out exactly like we want it, but it's going to come out and people are going to drink it. And so, but for him, you know, in making Saison specifically, I just feel like it's the way he approaches the craft and his attention to detail and just his understanding. And, you know, this is from working at Coop Ale Works too. Because if you're in a production brewery, you have to follow this tight process or things could go wrong quickly. And so he applies that big commercial brewing process to our small space.
A rigorous approach to a beer style that's renowned for its looseness. That's interesting. And I also think, you know, the other piece that you said there about brewing a whole bunch of small batches is the other interesting piece. I mean, when we look at, we think about breweries and planning a lot because we do events for breweries and planning. And I always, you know, we would always coach folks that, you know, your 2-barrel brew house, you know, is going to have a hard time making enough money for your business to support it, which is generally absolutely true on some level. But at the same time, those breweries that started small, you know, you look at like Aslin in Virginia, Burial in Asheville, that all started with these, you know, 2-barrel brew houses that don't make any commercial sense, you know, from a business plan standpoint, but instill this rigor and this idea that we have to brew a whole lot of beer, and the stakes are low for the mistakes. And so you can try a lot of things, and you learn through a year or two of brewing on that scale of, you know, by brewing almost daily, you learn a whole lot. About how to brew, and that can feed back into it. And so even if it's a bad business idea, ultimately can also pay off long term, just from having that kind of knowledge of the beer itself that you've brewed.
Right.
Interesting. Let's continue our process there, Will. After fermentation, you were talking earlier that you're going to let it go for 2 months before you bottle condition. So it's going to sit in that tank and you know, take up Joe's tank time, for a good 2 solid months. Where do you finish from there?
You mean how do I bottle condition?
Yeah, how do you bottle condition?
Yeah. So that is my base comes.
And these are pretty low acid, or, you know, I mean.
This one is, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I think we have a few others that are higher for sure.
Okay.
Like the.
What's your typical acid range, or is there a typical range of pH?
I mean, something like this. This is closer. This to me would be closer to classic Saison, but for something like the Tapestry from an Asteroid, that was barrel fermented with Brett. So that oxygen in there is going to definitely help that Brett go more tart. So I know I don't have a typical range. I have a range that I like.
What's the range that you like?
probably like 3-4, I think is really nice, where it's not too much. You got a balance there. But yeah,
Where is Oblique and Bent? Do you remember?
It's probably around 3.9.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's, you know.
It's not, its goal is not to be a tart Saison. It is.
No.
Yeah.
No. No. Just very drinkable. And the bottle conditioning, it's what do we do? We're only like 10 cases or something at a time. And, you know, a lot of this was, I mean, my base for bottle conditioning came off of like Milk the Funk, you know? Mm-hmm.
Sure.
Bob Sylvester's guidelines, but then I kind of bumped that up a little bit.
Oh man.
You bump it up a little bit.
Sure, sure.
Because I don't feel like I could get enough carbonation out of what he put on there. So that's where it.
Down there in Florida where Bob was.
Where, you know, Bob was, yeah.
It just gets so hot that it just tears off and does what it needs to do.
That's right.
Though he's in North Carolina now. Anything else to, you know, what's one of the more interesting variations on Saison that you've played with? You know, not necessarily one of your medal winners, but, you know, as going through your process, you know, what was a risk that you took and what did you learn through a process on one of these Saisons?
I think a risk for me would be starting to play with that sourdough.
Yeah.
And how I want that to react. It's like, when should I pitch it? Should I pitch that? Should I, you know, knock out at 90?
Right.
And let that sourdough rip for a day and then pitch my sack strains. I think that was probably one of the riskier moves. Oh, I thought it was risky, but it turned out.
what beer did that one become?
What was that? I think we ended up dry hopping that with Citra in the end. It was it was really nice. I almost probably shouldn't have dry hopped it. It was great on its own.
Probably should have held off on that. But he does use the sourdough strain in the brewery. I guess that would be kind of like a house strain, and we use it intermittently, like for different beers. He also makes the kvass called Goodbye Bread. That's made with sourdough. Starter. You
know, we make a bunch of sourdough loaves, and then we ferment it with our leaven.
So,
huh? And so then you're how much of the fermentation is handled by the sourdough and you know, versus the sack strains that we would expect to do heavy lifting of fermentation?
It's all the sourdough.
Really? Like,
yeah, I don't pitch. On that beer.
Okay.
I don't pitch anything else. It's just all of our sourdough.
And then when you pitch that sourdough yeast, like, you know, what are the constraints around it in order to get it to actually ferment to where you want it to go?
I might ferment that one in the 80s.
Okay.
But other than that, it's just kind of do what I do with bread.
You counting yeast cells or making sure that, are you stressing it or are you over pitching it? How do you?
No, I don't know what I'm doing with the yeast. Actually, we don't have a lab. So.
Oh, okay.
Right. And I
maybe not quite as rigorous as though. Okay.
Yeah.
All
yeah.
Right, all right.
Yeah. It's just throw it in there and see what it does. And I have had a bad batch of that before.
Huh.
And so I've upped the level of yeast and then it's fine. So, but I'm on a scale so that it doesn't matter that much. Like maybe I lost, you know, 2 bags of grain.
Right.
So, and my time.
Sure.
But
sure.
It wasn't that risky.
From a flavor standpoint, what do you like about the sourdough yeast and Saison?
I love the flavor of the bread that it gives. And it generally ends up in the pH range that I like.
It's also fruity.
It has a really nice kind of orange fruitiness to it.
Hmm.
Yeah, it's just really complex profile because this has so much in there.
It's kind of unexpected. You know, he did it the first time and it was like, well, this is pretty good. We should do it again. And so we've done it.
I think the first time is when I overpitched or when I overfed it before I used it on the beer. And so in that case, it had probably too much sack going in. And so it tasted like a Belgian wit that was 0.5%. And you're putting all the sourdough in it, so it has tons of body. There's so much protein in there. So this 0.5% beer tastes like it's 6%. I think one time I even, just because I was nervous, I blended in already finished Saison to it. It's like, well, maybe I need this, but I don't really. So.
Fair enough. Well, we've been talking about Saison for a while here, and I promised we'd talk about barrel-aged beers because, again, most recently it's on my mind because our malt issue is out right now, and you all scored incredibly high in that one. And this is your labor of love, Joe. So let's talk about your approach to making barrel-aged stouts.
Yeah.
Where do you start?
Well, the grain, for sure.
Sure.
The malt.
Sure.
I remember the very first stout I made was a clone out of the Extreme Brewing book.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And it was all extract recipes. And so we had to convert it to all grain. And we did our best. I was brand new to brewing, so I was mostly at the guidance of my friend Blake on this one, and that was in 2010. And ever since then, I've just been adapting the recipe almost every single time I've made it. And just knowing that every single grain or malt that is in the beer has a purpose. And, you know, it's just been really fun over the years to come up with something that I can finally say, this is what I wanted 14 years ago in the malt profile. And
let's track it back. So 14 years of development on this, and I just poured us some Bourbon Barrel Oil Boom, and that's the kind of the baseline standard, for your barrel-aged stouts that you then build into other beers through adjuncts.
Yeah, and this one actually is a different recipe than, I mean, this one has been adapted.
Okay.
But yes, this is very close to it. I was thinking this morning, and this is for all the IPA fans out there, that making Imperial Stout is kind of like blending a hazy IPA recipe with a West Coast IPA recipe and then adding some roasted malt in the mix. If you think about it.
Interesting. Elaborate on that for me.
So, you know, if you're brewing a hazy, you're probably using high protein malt like wheat or oats. You might use some chit. Flaked barley, we use flaked barley. we use Pilsner malt for IPA, but on a West Coast style, we'll use two row and we'll use some sort of crystal malt. And then if you add in a couple different, you know, roasted barley or debittered black, you got your stout. So you blend those two recipes and then you just add in. It's kind of like making a triple IPA, but adding a few things of...
And a lot less hops, but yeah.
I thought it was kind of funny. I was looking at the recipe over the past few days, and I was like, wait a second. But yeah, you know, everything about the stout that goes into it has a purpose, because there's things that you want to see or taste or smell in a stout. And so over the years, you know, things that have been important to me are having a really good body. And the body can go in two different directions. The flavor of that body can go in the vanilla caramel range, or more of like this roasted chocolate coffee. Or if you hit it right, you can have a really good mix of all of those. I love having a stout where it's got a really good mouthfeel, as I'm sure most people do.
Sure.
I always have the sun test. I want it to be as dark or as black as night. So I take stouts outside and I hold it up to the sun to see if the sun shines through it. I like having viscosity, you know, like lacing on the glass. I like the malt just to kind of slowly drizzle down the side of the glass. And of course, I don't want it to be too overcarbed to take away from the experience.
So what are some of the levers that you pull to achieve those things from a malt perspective first?
Yeah, I think this most recent recipe, it's gotten simpler and simpler over the years. I think when I first started, I really didn't know where flavors were coming from, but I would look at four or five recipes and be like, well, this, just pull this from this recipe and this from this recipe. And so I think we had up to 12 or 14 different malts at one point. And so I think we're down to maybe 7 or 8 at this point. And so the process has really been simplified, and I've learned things along the way.
Sure. What did you get rid of? What malts did you find weren't adding enough to it to justify the trouble of working them in?
Rye was one of them.
Okay.
I thought rye was going to, because of how dense the malt is, it would help with that viscosity, the lacing. And I feel like I could get that from other grains that I was already using. And so I think it was just taking away from the efficiency of the batch a little bit. And it thinned it out a little bit when I could have replaced that with a different grain. I can't really think of any other ones at the moment, but you know, we use two row. We've used Marisotto. I don't use Marisotto anymore. So,
okay.
But I'm not outside of using it again. And we
right. It's just that kind of within the scope of this much flavor, it's not adding enough to justify the additional expense and trouble of Marisotto.
Right, and if it's in our brew house for whatever reason and we need to get rid of it, I'll throw it in the stout. But we normally have two row or Pilsner, and so we just kind of use one of those and then build from there.
Interchangeably, even Pilsner malt and your Imperial stout.
I don't know that we've ever done that actually.
Okay.
But we have done two row, you know, we do two row. We do, I think on the most recent recipe, we're actually brewing a stout tomorrow, right? But on the most recent one, we used two row wheat, flaked oats, flaked barley, chit malt, some C40 or C90, and then debittered black malt along with some roasted barley. And I learned something on one of the podcasts. I'm not sure who you had on, but they were talking about approaching those roasted malts with pounds per barrel. Instead of, if you're increasing the ABV, you increase the percentages of all malts. And I've been using that ever since, because it's really helped to not overdo it on those roasted malts. And we're able to fit more of the good stuff in the mash tun.
How much, you know, percentage wise is base malt versus these adjuncts? And are the darker roasted malts, caramel malts? And then I imagine, you know, it's pretty standard that, it's pretty even distribution or smaller amounts of a couple of points of percentage, you know, for each of these in addition to a whole lot of base malt.
Yeah. The base malts, you know, wheat, 65% about, okay. And the rest are, it makes up the difference. Mm-hmm. With the roasted malts are about 25 pounds per barrel.
Mm.
So that ends up being about 10% of the overall Grispo.
Let's talk about your barrel aging process. Are you going into the barrel, you know, where do you go into the barrel gravity wise? And that I find, is an interesting lever that brewers are pulling to get different kind of, expressions through that barrel aging process.
We're going into the fermenter around 34, 35 P, and then we're trying to get 12 to 15 finishing gravity is kind of, we don't want to get below 12. We could probably get below 10. Like if we get below 10, it's probably not going to work.
Right.
But even if we're making something that's going into barrel, I've just found that I want to bump up the roasted barley and probably tone down the debittered black just so it can handle, the roast backing can handle sitting in a barrel for however long we have it there.
What do you mean? So you're saying the roast will age out faster?
The roast will help balance the flavors that the barrel, the bourbon is giving to the beer. And if you're leaving it in there for a while, that the heavy roast flavor will mellow out by the time you're going to package it.
So what's your average time in barrel, and how are you, like, what are some of the parameters you're thinking about, you know, in terms of like making sure that this beer is going to last? Obviously roast, like you said, will mellow out, you know, over that time. You want to have some of that sweetness there, you know, as it picks up, bourbon sweetness from a bourbon barrel, but also tannin and, you know, that kind of woody dryness, you know, all these things have to move forward together, talk to me about that process as it ages.
The aging process for us is we try to get it in there for about a year. And I think that through tasting it as it ages, I don't see much of a difference past 8 months to 12 months. And I don't know that we're so committed that we don't forget about our barrels. Like, in bigger brew houses, they just kind of sit and they can't get to them. And so they end up being a 24 or 36 month aging process. And we feel like at 12 months, the cost average, or we might as well just get it out because it tastes good. You can taste the barrel. You can taste the bourbon. It's come together. It's all the ingredients have been married in this liquid. And so there's been a couple times, and we're only 3 years old, but there's been a couple, I think one time where we've gone beyond 12 months, maybe 14 months. But for the most part, there's a few we put out that are just eight months old. Mm-hmm. And we're okay with that.
Are these barrel aged beers mainly single stream beers, or how much blending happens then on the back end?
So when we make a batch, we're filling two barrels every time. And so we probably take one barrel and make it its own thing and the other barrel its own thing, unless it's our anniversary party.
Now, saying two casks, right? Two bourbon barrels.
Yes.
Gotcha.
Yeah, two bourbon barrels of liquid. And we don't make that much stout comparatively to other breweries. Reminder, we're really small. And I think that we probably brew a stout maybe four times a year.
You know, it seems like such a simple process. And then, of course, the challenge of achieving excellence within a, you know, pretty crowded category of great beers. Y'all are doing something right there.
Thanks.
I don't have time to dig too deeply into that. And instead, I think we should, you know, kind of zoom out a little bit and think about big picture. You guys have been at it, you launched in November of 2020. It's 2024 now. for the next several years, what do you hope to achieve? Where would you like to be 3, 4, or 5 years from now? What do you see the Big Friendly being, and what's next for you all?
I'd like to pay off our debt, become more sustainable. We want to be...
Take the personal guarantee off of whatever debt you have, to some point there, right?
Yeah, and you know, so far, thankfully, we're on track.
7 years, yeah, it is 7 years for that, right?
7 years, yeah. I'm constantly trying to think how to become more sustainable now so we can dream about what it might look like then when that time comes. And I think one of the things that has helped us is that, you know, we were doing 120 events with the beer bus and the beer trailer, and we now have a short bus before we started, and that we're revenue producing, not just going to promote our product, that we're revenue producing events before we started. That's really helped us to be able to remain mostly taproom with very little distribution in play. And there's been a few other things I feel that have gone our way. We helped start a farmer's market right outside our brewery door every Friday night from, I think it runs from April through October. And that is great exposure for us. There's crit race, bike race that happens every Tuesday night for several months through the year. And so we tried to use the tap room, open it up as an office space for people and charge like a small amount for people to use the office. There's a few people that have taken us up on that idea. So we consider doing an Airbnb in our space, which we still are considering that. And we always are trying to think, should we distribute? Should we go a little bit bigger? Do we want the headache of that? Or, you know, how can we do that? If we were going to do that, could we contract the extra production? Would that make it any sense with the margins being so low as they are? Should we open a second tap room? You know, all those questions we're working through actively. I think about them every day. I was thinking about them on the airplane on the way here. And so you have to get creative in today's market. And you would think that running a brewery would be a piece of cake. You know, you're just hanging out, drinking beer with your friends. But it's a tough business. And, you know, we're working with 2-3% of our population is even craft beer drinkers. And that's not like it is here in Colorado. So I think if we are consistent...
It's the same grind everywhere now, yeah. You know? Like even, you know, yeah, you have more drinkers, but you also have more breweries and...
yeah, right.
You know, and so it's the same grind, yeah.
Yeah, so I think that if we just keep pressing into this creative outlet and actually following through on implementation of some of these things, you'll start to see the result maybe in the coming months, maybe the next year, but by the time 7 years rolls around, there's some really cool things that start to take shape, and hopefully we can be a staple in the community there in Oklahoma City. We're right in the middle of a brand new neighborhood. The land that we're on was vacant land when we committed to opening a brewery, and now there's 200 or 300 houses, and there's plans for another 1,500 or so houses over the next few years. So that's going to help us out quite a bit as well. But I think that our plan is just for today. Like, what are we going to do today
right.
to make it to tomorrow? And what are we going to do tomorrow to make it to the next day? And we dream about the future, but we don't really think about it that much. We want to make good beer. We want to be good people. We want that to show in our tap room. And we got lucky winning a few awards, and you know, there's a lot of really good beer out there. And we've learned a lot from people that have gone before us, people that have given us free information along the way on the business side, on the brewing side. And we're just really grateful to be in the industry. There's some pretty amazing people in the industry, and we get to be a part of that.
Well, I think that's a great place to bring this to close. Choose G&D Chillers on your next expansion or brewery startup and receive one free year of remote control and monitoring. Schedule a time now to meet with ProBrew at CBC Booth 1783. Old Orchard is the go-to source for fruit-forward ingredients for some of the biggest names in the craft brewing landscape. Omega Yeast's Diastole Knockout Series is comprised of 8 familiar yeast strains engineered to knock out the formation of diastole before it starts. ABS Commercial are proud to offer brewhouses, tanks, keg washers, and preventative maintenance parts to brewers across the country. If you're a distiller or curious about it, check out our Craft Spirits and Distilling podcast. SS BrewTech is dedicated to an engineering-first approach to brewery equipment and powers R&D at some of the world's greatest breweries, and build consistency with a reverse osmosis system from uswatersystems.com. If you've enjoyed this episode, subscribe to Craft Beer and Brewing. Go to beerandbrewing.com, click on that subscribe button. If you work in the industry or you're a brewery, choose that industry all-access subscription and get access to the great stories that Kate writes, like the one she wrote that includes extensive insight from you guys at the Big Friendly on the reason and viability and approach to entering competitions. If people want to learn more about the Big Friendly, Joe and Will, where can they find more about you all?
The Big Friendly on Instagram, at the Big Friendly, and thebigfriendly.com.
Well, all right. I have enjoyed tasting your approach to excellent beers. Obviously, our judges have as well as the GABF judges. All the best luck in the future as you get through this 2024 competition season. We've been talking, but I got to get you on the road so you can grab a little bit of lunch, maybe a beer, and then get back to the airport for your flight. Same day flight back to Oklahoma City. It's been great talking to you about brewing. Cheers.
Thank you.
Thanks.
This podcast has been brought to you by Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine for those who love to make and drink great beer. To learn more or to subscribe, visit beerandbrewing.com or find us on social media at Craft Beer Brew.